We're absolutely delighted to be running a new SRC seminar series entitled New Ageing Populations. The aim of our seminar series is to hold a series of six seminars over 2 years, looking at the growth of new groups of ageing populations that we think have really been fueled by advances in biotechnology and the changing social contexts and social attitudes that we have in contemporary societies. So during the series, we've been looking at groups with traditionally life-limiting diseases that have now been able to live into mid or later life because of the different treatments and care that they're able to receive. We're also looking at the limits of how long we could potentially live, and if we can succeed in extending life past 100 or 120 years, what the social implications would be for a burgeoning ageing population. So this is the fourth seminar in our series. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Professor Brian Turner and Aubrey de Grey to our seminar. And one of the aims of our series is actually to bring in as many different academic disciplines, public interest groups, individuals, to listen to the debates that arise out of our New Ageing Population series. And I'm also delighted to welcome Deborah Dunn-Walters, who's a senior lecturer in immunobiology here at King's, who will be chairing the seminar for us. Just to say, we have built in a very short comfort break halfway through. The toilets are out and straight down the corridor on the ground floor, should you wish to use them. Thank you.
Good afternoon. We're very fortunate today to have these two people with us who have spent a lot of time thinking about the consequences of an aging population. Firstly, I'd like to introduce Professor Brian Turner from the Graduate Center, City University, New York. Brian is one of the world's leading sociologists of religion. And he's also devoted significant attention to sociological theory, the study of human rights, and the sociology of the body. His current research involves the role of religion in contemporary Asia and the changing nature of citizenship in a globalizing world. Professor Turner has written, co-authored, or edited more than 70 books and more than 200 articles and chapters. He is a founding editor of the journals Body and Society, Citizenship Studies, and Journal of Classical Sociology. Professor Turner is also a professor of social and political thought at the University of Sydney, Australia. He holds a PhD from the University of Leeds and has been awarded a Doctor of Letters from both Flinders University in South Australia and the University of Cambridge. Professor Turner will present his paper, A Modest Proposal of Geriatric Storage.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you for that introduction. For some years I've been interested in the sociology of the body. I think that's because I'm about 5'3", wanted to be a fast overarm bowler, but had to become an academic instead, and have been sort of disappointed with my body ever since. I've been the editor of, or one of the editors of this book on the sociology of the body, and much of recent sociological humanities research on the body has been interested in the idea of social construction, that is, that the human body can be manufactured both culturally and socially and medically in various ways, and that this idea about the social construction of the body has been particularly important, for example, in debates about gender, where the historic division between men and women has been problematized by feminist theories of social construction. But in my view, much of the notions about social construction really need to be tested against the ideas of the sociology of aging. And in my own work, I've been trying to defend what I call a foundationist view, or a foundationist epistemology of the body, in which I try to argue that diabetes, pancreatitis, aging processes actually have a real impact on the body, and that social constructionism doesn't provide us with much guidelines to this phenomenon of aging. And I jokingly say that social constructionism is a theory for young people. Namely that ageing has problems that social construction doesn't really address. I'm going to read much of this paper, I'm afraid, because I think some of the arguments here are too complicated to actually simply remember off the cuff, as it were. When I begin to run out of time, I might have to simply memorise parts of this paper. I often feel that we fail to make an adequately sharp distinction between what we might call individual rationality and collective rationality. Most of the classical models of rationality, especially in economics and in social sciences, that adopts a position of so-called methodological individualism, thereby denying that any collective entities like society exist, are based upon some notion that individuals are the only or mostly motivated by self-interest. Mrs. Thatcher famously said, "There are no such things as society," thereby epitomising the idea of individual rationality and methodological individualism. It's further assumed that, for example, individuals striving to maximise their private interests will have a positive benefit on society. In classical theory, Mandeville argued private vices are public virtues, and every conservative government from Ronald Reagan onwards has accepted this argument. Cameron in Britain, I think, currently represents this as well. In their extreme forms, these arguments tend to assume that there is no insurmountable problem of scarcity in modern societies, or that if there is a problem of scarcity, it's better solved largely by market intervention. In the current economic crises in the United States, United Kingdom, Iceland, and most of the European community, we're still in the grip of this logic of individualized rationality. The principal solutions are on offer are either post-Keynesianism or arguments about cutting state expenditure to meet current crises. The fact that the current crisis was caused by unregulated financial and housing markets has apparently not been noticed by contemporary governments or economic theorists, apart from a few anarchists in Athens and elsewhere. Is the pursuit of self-interest or market fundamentalism in the interests of the community? Now, I start with this kind of argument because I'm interested in whether my individual interests in living forever have a kind of collective responsibility attached to them. There are anthropological accounts, for example, of Native American societies or villages in feudal Japan, in which the old and the infirm were left out in the snow or in cold winters or abandoned on mountainsides in order to protect the life of the community. These accounts, of course, are often disputed by anthropologists, but they illustrate my argument that we should at least consider the difference between private rationality, I don't want to be abandoned on a hillside, and collective rationality, we have to abandon you because we have an inadequate set of resources to keep us all alive. For the sake of intergenerational reproduction of the community, we have to kill you off in order for the next generation to survive. In short, a Malthusian problem of scarcity meant that the elderly could not be allowed to survive once they had reached beyond reproduction. Faced with natural scarcity, a short lifespan was in the interests of the collectivity. Modern medical sciences and much of the social science appears to believe that these forms of scarcity are largely a thing of the past. We may have to create queues in a modern medical or welfare system, but in practice, the Malthusian dilemma is not a serious issue. Let's offer people longevity and try to solve the problems about scarcity and queuing if and only when they arise. These conventional problems, self-interest, efficiency, market, scarcity and inequality, do not therefore emerge very significantly, in my view, in many scientific medical debates, especially in biogerontology, about longevity. It's assumed that it's self-evidently in my interest to live forever, or at least for as long as possible. Most human beings, when faced with the question, would you like to live longer, especially much longer, would embrace the possibility with enthusiasm. I certainly would. But traditionally, the only possible exception to this promise would be that I don't want to live indefinitely if it means that I'll have to suffer increasingly poor health, disability, and immobility. Most human beings in the past have died willingly, even enthusiastically, to avoid the pain, discomfort, indignity, and misery of old age. What has changed in recent years is the notion that we could have both longevity and good health, that is, longevity and rejuvenation. When I completed the manuscript of my book, Can We Live Forever?, it was sent out for review, and it came back with some very damning criticisms. It must have gone to a medical doctor, probably from Cambridge, because it came back with some criticisms relating to a Greek myth about Tithonus. And in writing this book, I'd never heard of Tithonus. But anyway, Tithonus, who was a mere mortal, falls in love with the goddess Eos, the beautiful goddess of the dawn. Realizing, however, that Tithonus would eventually die, she begs Zeus to grant her lover the gift of immortality. Being a jealous god, Zeus literally grants her wish, and Tithonus did indeed enjoy the immortal life, but he did not have the additional and crucial blessing of eternal youth. As Tithonus grew old, he also became decrepit, and Eos, finding her demented lover to be a disgusting and unbearable burden, was driven to despair by his senile and senseless babbling. Finally, Eos transforms the decaying Tithonus into a cicada creature, insect, whose ceaseless mechanical chirping provided a parody of the babbling of aging and decaying Tithonus. So the claim, I think, of contemporary medical immortalism is that medical science and technology can solve this Tithonus cross puzzle by simultaneously granting us immortality and eternal youth. By contrast, critics of medical science argue that the project of longevity is not desirable since senility cannot be overcome by technology, and while we might survive indefinitely, our troublesome physical discomforts and disabilities will inevitably accompany our longevity. The pessimistic argument is that while medicine may bring blessings to individuals, medical technology cannot overcome the collective problem of scarcity. In addition, these life extension products raise basic questions about employment, retirement, pensions, and so on and so forth, for which we have few adequate long-term policy solutions. And recent neoliberal attempts to privatise pensions and related services and investment funds may have compounded rather than solved the existing institutional arrangements. Thus, the contemporary debate, which involves an awareness that many developed societies are experiencing rapid ageing of their populations and the realisation that there are medical interventions that could in principle significantly extend longevity, divides academics, people into optimists or immortalists and pessimists or so-called deathists. More profoundly, it divides people into those with a utopian vision of what is technologically possible in modern societies, and those with a dystopian vision who emphasise the negative economic and possibly inhumane and inhuman consequences of any significant extension of human life. In returning to this debate this evening, I want to try to make the following arguments. Firstly, because medical science, like some branches of scientific sociology, does not address the moral questions directly relating to ageing, it does not engage with any question about whether life actually is worth preserving. Of course, there is medical ethics, but a scientist working on a cure for cancer or on cancer for particular patients does not ask, is this life or life in general worth saving? Medical science per se simply assumes that life itself requires no justification. It simply is. In my view, this value neutrality, to use a phrase associated with the sociology of Max Weber, thereby fails to address an obvious distinction between existence and life. So my question this afternoon is, longevity might be may be justified simply as a matter of existence, but what would life itself be and how would that be justified? Modern gerontology may aim at sustaining our survival, but not at life. The question, can we live forever, in a medical framework, can only mean, can we exist forever? The answer to existence is nearly technical, namely, to discover what medical interventions might extend existence over a given period of time. In my view, there is still a separate and more important question: what might be meaningful or rewarding or satisfactory as life, as opposed to mere existence? Not existence, but life, prolonged more or less indefinitely, can that be meaningful? To make an obvious example, would an indefinite life be an extremely boring life? I'm sceptical that psychiatric medical science could ever produce or discover an appropriate medication for boredom, which is what most moral and sociological states of affairs would be like, I think, in old age. Can life, with the aid of modern medical technology and significant economic investment in healthcare, be extended more or less indefinitely? This question can be formulated in at least two ways. Namely, can we survive indefinitely, and ought we to live indefinitely? One is a simply factual question about the medical interventions that would be necessary for human beings to extend their lives beyond, say, 120 years. The second is an ethical, possibly spiritual issue about the project of longevity and how it might be justified. Medical arguments often assume that the extension of life needs no justification whatsoever, since life itself is worth preserving. Medical ethics, along with most religious doctrines, commit doctors to preserving life, and hence in many societies euthanasia is thought, at least under, as far as I understand, English common law, to be illegal, and therefore euthanasia, without further question, is not regarded as having compelling moral foundations. The assumption is that to preserve life needs no justification. In practice, of course, doctors and nurses will often take into account situational factors showing a concern for questions relating to the quality of life of the chronically sick. Such patients may simply be allowed to die rather than being subjected to continuous evasive medicine. Can we live forever? This question asks whether the mere survival of the human body can be extended beyond the contemporary limit of around 120 years. Perhaps the obvious question, at least in the short term, is rather negative. When I propose this manuscript, Can we live forever? One or two cynics commented to me that it would be a very short book. While there are now many more centenarians around, the final stages of life for the majority of people in modern societies, even in the developed world, are typically punctuated by degrading and painful periods of sickness and disability. But these common sense responses to the question may, without further reflection, commit us prematurely to a pessimistic view of life as inevitably and necessarily fixed and limited. Medical optimists want us to at least to consider the possibility that not only can life be extended, but it can be dramatically improved. Do we have a right to longevity? In various recent publications of mine, particularly a book called Vulnerability and Human Rights, I attempt to criticise human rights theories for failing to take seriously, the issue of resources. It's one thing to say that we have a right to life or a right to health, but this normative argument does not tell us anything at all about the resources that might be available to sustain a right to life more or less indefinitely. Perhaps we have a right to good health care, but not an automatic right to life. Furthermore, there is a good old-fashioned liberal question: is the indefinite extension of my life, my individual rationality, compatible with the enjoyment of life of other persons within my community? This principle that in a fair society, my enjoyment of entitlements and rights should not seriously disadvantage other individuals in my society is fundamental to the philosophy of writers such as Isaiah Berlin and John Rawls, but these liberal arguments don't surface too frequently, in my view, in the biogerontological debates about longevity. In my book, Can We Live Forever?, I pointed to the obvious issue that while life expectancy has been rising progressively in places like Northern Europe and in many parts of Asia, especially Japan, it's stationary or declining in many parts of Africa, for example. If we can extend life in the developed world, there is the obvious problem that in many war-torn and impoverished societies in the world, life expectancy may shrink rapidly. In this regard, I'm influenced by the work of people like Nancy Shepherd Hughes in her anthropological research on the global sale of organs, particularly kidneys, which brings out the gross inequalities between different societies with regard to modern medical interventions such as organ transplants, in which she shows quite clearly that whilst the recipients of organs in the developed world enjoyed better lives, the lives of the donors are inherently miserable and impoverished. In the past 2 years, I've been living in the United States, and as a result, I feel I have a better insight into the operation of healthcare in different parts of the world, having lived in recent years in Singapore, Australia, Britain, the Netherlands, Germany, and now America. In this talk this afternoon, I want to look at how the present economic crisis might influence health inequalities within developed societies, not simply by looking, as I've just said, between the developed and the underdeveloped world. In the current crisis, European societies have sought to cut government support for welfare, education, health, and as a result, it seems to me that Britain in particular is going through a period of Americanization in terms of health and education. America, which has some of the best health institutions in the world, is a long way down, of course, in the league of life expectancy. According to a recent report from the CIA World Facebook from 2009, America, for example, in terms of the league of life expectancy, ranks at number 36 in the world, with a life expectancy of around 78 years. Japan, as you well know, comes out as number one with a life expectancy of 82.6. Other countries at the top of the league were Australia, 81.2, UK, 79.4. But at the bottom of the league, we have Botswana, 50 years, 0.7, Malawi, 48, Central African Republic, 44, Zambia, 42, and ranked at 194 was Swaziland, with a life expectancy of 39.6 years. These are obviously crude figures, but they offer a rough snapshot of social and economic trends. When one looks at gender and race, it becomes more interesting, obviously. Returning to the United States, if you examine projections from the US Census Bureau of 2011 statistical abstracts, life expectancy in the US is projected to rise from 78.3 in 2010 to 79.5 in 2020, but the figure for black Americans are 73.8 in 2010, 79.5 years in 2020. In other words, black Americans in 2020 will have caught up with the life expectancy that is currently enjoyed in Belize and New Caledonia. In other words, the prospects of longevity and rejuvenation will be unevenly distributed, obviously, between societies, between the developed and the undeveloped world, but significantly within societies. This issue of inequality within societies raises yet another issue of the individual versus the collective. I do not doubt that most, if not all, doctors practicing in modern medicine have outstanding moral values and are motivated to help their patients. The Harold Shipmans of this world are fortunately few and far between. The enormity of his crimes only serves to highlight the fact that we can trust our local practitioners. However, the virtues and values of individuals in the healthcare system do not necessarily tell us very much about the system as a whole. My contention is the common sense one that modern medicine exists to make money rather than to cure illness or disease. In a famous commentary on American medicine, Paul Starr, in the book called The Social Transformation of American Medicine, showed how the daily practice and decision-making of doctors was influenced by the commercial interests of insurance companies and pharmaceutical industries. The costs of healthcare with modern technology are now rising steeply with the aging of populations, with the result that only those with adequate healthcare insurance can expect to receive adequate treatment. In America, as I'm sure you know, 45 million citizens have no adequate healthcare coverage, and it's unclear still how much of the Obama healthcare program will be enacted, given the objections of the Republican Party and the popular criticisms of the Tea Party. The campaign mounted by the Tea Party characterized Obama's reforms as socialism, and in the long run, the pressures on the Democratic Party to further reduce state expenditures on health and education will be considerable. In the meantime, tax breaks for the wealthy have been carried over from the Bush era into the Obama administration. This argument, modern medicine exists to make money, seems to me to be merely common sense. But there is a more intriguing, if worrisome, argument, which is that because disease is economically productive, there is no pressing profit motive to cure disease, only to contain it and to prolong it. In the context of privatized medicine and profit-driven medical technology, there is little incentive to cure such illnesses as diabetes, but there is an incentive to keep diabetic patients alive into old age, because then they will need to keep purchasing insulin, metformin, glipizide, blood pressure medication such as Avapro, various instruments such as syringes, blood pressure machines, blood testing strips, and so on and so forth. Keeping patients alive indefinitely is not aimed at solving the Tithonus puzzle. Keeping patients alive but sick may be more profitable than keeping them alive and well. These economic consequences, let me stress, have nothing whatsoever to do with the honourable and occasionally positive motivations of individual doctors. And in this system of profit-driven medicine, it wouldn't matter one hoot whether all doctors were practising Christians or practising Buddhists. My approach here is driven by the assumption that given scarcity and the dominance of markets, the outcome is inevitably one of inequality, first between the global north and the south, but also within societies that do not have significant safety nets against the consequences of an ageing population. In Can We Live Forever, in my book, I argue that a program to promote human longevity could only be supported by a program to reform society, to reduce inequality, to promote, to protect the vulnerable, to redistribute resources, to improve the educational level of the population as a whole, and to reduce gender inequalities within society. In short, longevity requires social reform, and both of these depend upon adequate social citizenship. The protection of the public domain and the regulation of the market to moderate social inequalities that necessarily accompany the naked logic of the market seems to me to be a necessity. This program is not necessarily a plan for socialism necessarily, but at least the democratization of the public domain. It is, however, to recognize that the essentially private quest for longevity must produce significant social inequalities within and between societies. Despite these arguments, I'm convinced that my position can only ultimately fail because the interests driving the longevity agenda are too powerful. There are plenty of critics, of course, of the idea of pro-longevity and geriatric good health, and there are some kind of humorous and serious objections all the way back to Anthony Trollope, who argued that there should be a fixed period to human life in which the elderly should be got rid of. In addition, many authors have drawn attention to the fact that the baby boomer generation, namely my generation, have just arrived at the crossroads where many of them are now faced with retirement on a low income and with the erosion of their standing in society. And this social group, this baby boomer generation, is obviously going to resist the idea that they should be marginalised, and they were welcomed with enthusiasm the whole agenda of regeneration medicine. Obviously, this generation has been particularly prominent and successful given its size and the particular time and place in which many of them, me, were born. Namely, coming to age in a period of economic and social reconstruction. Will this generation easily let go of power and wealth? I think the answer is no. My argument and other critical opposition to the Typhoonus project of longevity will either fail or be ignored for the very obvious reason that longevity will have the full support of a baby boomer generation. They will want resources redirected towards the age group over 65 rather than to younger generations. Secondly, there is a huge incentive for the scientific establishment to achieve a breakthrough in the genetics of ageing. Gerontology, which has for decades been the backwater of medical science, is now at the forefront. Thirdly, there is a significant global economy associated with stem cell research, cryogenics, geriatric medicine, organic transplants, cosmetic surgery, and so on and so forth. Arguments about the quality of life in old age, or about the redistribution of resources, or about a global responsibility for population and development, will receive short shrift. Arguments in favour of good health in old age and longevity have an obvious common sense appeal and attraction, partly because they appeal to our sense of personal survival, and partly because they are apple pie arguments. Everybody is in favour of long health and good health. However, in my view, they fail to address the very obvious problems of the political economy of ageing and demography, the political questions associated with equality, human rights issues, and so on and so forth. The debate about longevity typically and unsurprisingly starts by concentrating on the global rise of life expectancy. But I think much more interesting is another issue related to all of this, which is the decline in fertility rates. While the rise in life expectancy in general terms is a major factor in social change, there seems to me to be something that is even more important, namely the worldwide decline, dramatic decline in female total fertility rates. In other words, the demographic structure of modern societies is squeezed from both ends in terms of rising life expectancy at one end and population ageing, plus a rapid decline in the number of young people in the age structure of modern societies. Many countries now are already in the so-called sub-replacement fertility of below 2.1 live births per woman. For example, Japan began reporting sub-replacement fertility as early as the 1950s, but this situation is now typical of the whole of East Asia, much of Southeast Asia, Thailand, the Caribbean, much of Latin America. Surprisingly, it's also significant in virtually all Muslim societies. Even more problematic, for example, is the Chinese example, where family policies have reduced fertility rates to 1.5 children per woman. These changes in fertility mean an important reduction in the workforce of most societies that is combined with rapid ageing populations. The most dramatic collapse, for example, has occurred in Russia, where the population has shrunk from 148.6 million in 1993 to 141.9 million today. In many societies, such as Singapore, the attempt to increase fertility rates of women has failed. In Singapore recently, if two Chinese students went out for a meal that was going to lead towards an engagement, the government promised to pay the costs of their honeymoon meals and parties and so forth to try to encourage fertility growth in Singapore. It's failed miserably for various reasons. The principal response to population decline has been to support immigration. But this strategy also creates problems of integration and assimilation, as we've seen in Denmark, America, Sweden, Australia, etc., etc. So declining fertility rates could be addressed by increasing immigration, but the great growth in global racism, I think, has made that much more problematic.
Japan, for example, has strongly resisted emigration, relying on short-term work contracts and hoping that advanced technology could help to resist the dependence on foreign workers. The other strategies are to remove the retirement age, which, as we have seen in 2010, was much resisted in places such as France. Other strategies include the cutting of pension benefits or to privatise them. Some American cities recently, such as Pritchard in Alabama, where they are virtually bankrupt, have cancelled payments to retirees from public pension funds. The other strategy, of course, and the one that concerns us this evening, is to extend the working life of the population by solving the ageing problem by creating healthy, long-living workers in the absence of young children. Rather than enjoying the pleasures of retirement, if the longevity project is successful, for people to live forever is also to work forever. These demographic and economic changes raise a very large question about the capacity of nation states to provide adequately for their citizens in a context of scarcity. According to the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations, there was severe price rises, as you know, in 2007 and 2008 in all foods, especially in grains, oils and fats. These price hikes were followed in many countries by severe political instability. There were similar increases in late 2010 with political violence in Tunisia and Algeria in January. The UN has estimated that there are already around 1 billion people who are not fed enough to survive adequately, and this will rise as world food prices continue to increase. As another measure, let's take the question of oil. There is a major disagreement, of course, among specialists about whether the developed industrial world will in fact run out of oil, or at least affordable oil. But increases in energy costs will have widespread negative consequences for many developing societies. For example, there was a steep increase in price in the oil price in 2008, when truck drivers throughout much of Europe, particularly in the Mediterranean, were out on the streets blocking roads and so on and so forth. There are also food riots and urban crises in places as far apart as Haiti, Egypt, Philippines, Vietnam, Thailand and so forth, where in particular Thailand stopped exporting rice last year in order to safeguard its own supplies. And I could go on through this list of crises. So what I'm trying to establish here is a problem of scarcity in relation to an ageing problem and an ageing population and a significant reduction in the working population given a decline in female fertility. Current thinking, and so this kind of raises for me a question about how far a human right to life or an extended life could be supported in a context of scarce resources. In my view, the debates about fundamental rights of life, for example, contain very little about the issue of resources. Academic works on human rights characteristically lack any significant serious attention to the political economy or the foundations of resources. There are at least two issues here. One is that given social and economic inequality, the distribution of resources is essentially unequal, and therefore the majority of human beings are all too often condemned to short and unpleasant lives. The obvious measure of this inequality is the variable nature of human life expectancy between the rich and the poor, as I've already illustrated in earlier parts of this talk. These two issues, rights and resources, are not normally discussed in relation to scarcity. If resources were equally distributed, then people would not experience such unequal forms of scarcity. The enjoyment of human rights would therefore require major social reforms to change the ways in which free markets, for example, operate. This view of scarcity is based ultimately on some notion that scarcity is socially produced, and so one of the debates we might have this afternoon is the very notion of scarcity. By contrast, the classical political economists regarded scarcity as naturally produced. In this lecture, I want to argue that resources, while socially mediated, are nevertheless finite, claiming along with Malthus that given the contemporary demographic problems, technological change will never overcome and may indeed intensify the re-emerging problem of resources in relation to longevity. Resources, in my view, are finite, and there is therefore an inevitable accumulation of waste that will come with all forms of economic growth. I better start coming to a conclusion. 10 minutes, okay. I want to turn to two issues to finish. One is what I regard as a kind of medical position that life needs no justification, where in my view, extended life does need two justifications. And in this book of mine, Can We Live Forever?, I propose two forms of justification, which I very briefly want to consider here. One is a kind of an aesthetic argument that I take from writers like Nietzsche, that human life is a sort of journey in which we try to become who we are, to quote Nietzsche, that I think that if we could regard life as a kind of journey in which we're trying to refashion ourselves in a continuous way, then extended life could be justified on sort of ethical and aesthetic grounds as a constant process of self-recreation. And one of the books that inspired me recently was a book by Tony Judt, J-U-D-T, who was an Englishman who lived in New York for a long time, writing in the New York Times, who died recently of ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And in this state of almost total paralysis, wrote some wonderful articles for the New York Review, for the New York Times, which were published recently in a book called Memory Chalet, in which Judt, more or less totally incapacitated, wrote these wonderfully reflective articles on his own life. And so I would sort of present his life as an aesthetic account of how we might try to justify extended life as a sort of process of constant reconstruction, self-development, and so forth. And I think the other is a kind of argument from citizenship, which is that life could be justified insofar as we constantly contribute to the total resources of a society through the notion that human rights, social rights, are contributory rights, that is, that the entitlements we have from society correspond in some way to the sorts of inputs we make into a society. So that's too brief in order to justify that, but what I want to say here this afternoon is I don't think life itself has any particular justification. Life extension has to have some sort of moral, ethical, aesthetic justification. In my view, that can mean only self-creation over time, self-renewal, self-production, or some idea of contribution to society. So Tony Judt, dying through this terrible disease in which he was totally immobilized, manages to write these wonderful articles, which bring all of us a considerable amount of pleasure. To conclude, this talk this afternoon was based upon a reflection on Jonathan Swift's modest proposal for how to cope with the surplus of starving Irish children in the middle of the early part of the 18th century. And with Jonathan Swift, who was a systematic critic of English colonialism, suggested that the only way of coping with the Irish famine was to eat the surplus children of the Irish population, and that young children under the age of 12 would be tasty, supple morsels that we could all enjoy, thereby getting rid of the burden on their parents. And my modest proposal this afternoon, given the fact of an aging population and a shrinking working population, if these demographic procedures continue, I think we have two options. One is the Jonathan Swift modest proposal to deep freeze the elderly cryonically to keep them in storage in large vats or warehouses in the assumption that eventually rejuvenation medicine could bring them back to a healthy life and they could be brought back into a society to sustain economic growth. Or, if rejuvenated medicine is successful, that all of us will work forever because there will be no young working population. But in the past, as Peter Laslett used to say, we had societies with relatively few old people and lots of young people. The society of the future will be lots of old people and no young people. Therefore, either deep freeze the elderly or make them work forever. So, with that modest proposal, I conclude.